This is Sam Edwards, proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network, SurreyFarms.com.
Pure energy. Pure energy. Pure energy.
I want to know what you're thinking. There are some things you can't hide. I want to know what you're feeling. Tell me what's on your mind.
Pure energy.
Yes, we are burning down the house here on the Heritage Radio Network, heritageradionetwork.org. This afternoon, I want to talk about the end of the oil age, purely a discussion about energy. With us will be our frequent guest, Duo Dickinson Architect, whose practice has been largely, I believe, directed at populating the ex-urban areas of the landscape or the suburban milieu. Are you with us, Duo?
I are here.
Okay, cool. And also, we want to talk with the author, James Howard Kunstler, especially about his most recent book, Too Much Magic. Jim, are you with us?
I am.
Hey, super. Excellent. Not that I intentionally want to put you guys at odds, but Jim, you
are... It makes for good radio, though.
We can only hope that it will be something worthy of professional wrestling. James Howard Kunstler. Jim, you are the, I would say, the premier anti-suburbanist, the most vocal and perhaps the most eloquent voice of, I would say, reason, examining all aspects of... the coming failure of the suburban and what you call the happy motoring experience. And so here are some topics that I want to talk about. The case that you've set forth in your argument in Too Much Magic, that life as we know it will soon come to a halt and there will be severe contraction of economies all over the globe. You've written in other books and in your blog postings about the decline of suburbia and the collapse of the whole automotive transportation system that supports that. Duo, I know that you do a lot of driving and you have projects all over the place, and I'm sure that we'll get into the aspects of what it would be like when eventually the oil does run out. And I would just like for us to take a couple moments to phrase our thinking. I mean, it's not like we don't have clues every day. You just read the papers and you see that there are these extreme measures being taken to attempt to extract shale oil through hydrofracturing, also known as fracking. It's not that as if nature isn't cluing us into the fact that there are finite resources of carbon-based fuel that can be extracted from the earth, and, well, let's talk about what that's going to be like when we have to return to some previous mode of economic activity. Joe, could we have a few minutes of our first musical break?
Just wait, tell you something's wrong. It's nature's wait, tell you in a song. It's nature's way of receiving you. It's nature's way of retrieving you.
Mr. Kunstler, are you still with us?
Yeah.
All right, you have the floor. Tell us, what are you thinking? What do we get to enjoy looking ahead? What's going to happen? What's going to happen to this world?
Well, I think the just to clarify the situation, it's not about running out of oil. There will still be plenty of oil around, but it will probably be too expensive to get, and it will be found in places that are too forbidding to work in, in one way or another. It's really a matter of the complex systems that we depend on for everyday life becoming unstable, and then reinforcing each other's mutual instabilities, and then collapsing. So, you know, it's about what happened. And, you know, it's interesting to see that the complex system, which has turned out to be the most fragile, is the banking system.
Well, that's for sure.
Probably largely because it's the most abstract of all the ones that we depend on. You know, and the other, they can be described with precision. You know, the way we produce food, that's one complex system. In our case, it's petro-agriculture or agribusiness. The way we do commerce, which is Walmart and things like it. You know, the way we do transportation, which is happy motoring, etc. So, you know, you start to get problems with one system, like the motoring system or the oil market system or the financial system, you're going to get problems in all these other systems. You know, an example is that agribusiness requires a certain things to perform what it does. But one of them, one of the big inputs that it requires, apart from oil and gas products and diesel fuel and fertilizers, the thing that they really need is capital. And what we're going to find out, you know, that, and this is why the financial situation right now is so critical, is that we're not going to have the capital to proceed to fund the systems that we depend on.
Right.
You know, whether it's the 12,000-mile supply line to Walmart or the warehouse on wheels or agribusiness or mass motoring. And, you know, it's falling apart at the margins right now in a lot of ways that are not being felt closer to the center.
Yeah. Well, Duo and I certainly can address what the collapse of the financial speculative markets meant in terms of construction.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with everything Mr. Kunstler just said. I think the one thing that I think made it perverse was in speculative banking involving houses, which really was one building type that tanked the entire world economy in one country, which was the speculation on the value of a single family detached American home. What I think was made bizarrely over the top, manipulated, was the essential human desire to own a place where they live that catapults the amount of money that you're willing to risk into a stratospheric miscalculation, abetted, obviously, by the hype and the profit-mongering of huge builders and giant banks. But, you know, a lot of people are encouraged to buy a lot of things that flop, you know, the Edsel or any other type of mass-marketed item. And the truth is, it's hard for anyone not to want to own the place they live.
I think that's specious. I think that's an entirely American and largely 20th century creation. You know, that you have to own the place in which you live.
Oh, I'm not saying have to. I'm saying want to.
I don't even know that people want to. I think that is totally created by advertising.
Well, I would hope that the thing is that I wish what you said was true, because that would have avoided about 20 million people buying houses they couldn't afford in the last decade. So but the problem is that you get into an irrational mode of fulfilling some form of destiny that might be uniquely American, but I think everybody in the world lives somewhere and wants to have a better place to live, depending on how you find it, to define it. That kind of irrational exuberance, to paraphrase another economy-driven mindset, I think created the platform that you could have you know, unsustainable speculation, and raises the specter, is there unsustainable speculation, just as Mr. Kunstler said, in any number of different places.
Well, back to the banking system. What I find, and Duo, you had to have had clients who were flippers. Come on.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I mean when that level of avarice of flip and
indeed
flip and make a killing. I mean, it's like you know. Okay, we're on the internet, so I can say this. It's like the zipless fuck. Okay.
Yeah.
That didn't work. It didn't even work for Erica Jong. It didn't work for any of us who went through college in the late 60s or 70s. The zipless fuck of real estate speculation, it didn't work because there was no value there. There was no
Bingo.
Meaning.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. But there was always a buyer, and that was the problem, because there would be no flipping if somebody didn't think they were buying something that they liked, not to flip it, but buying it from the flipper because they said, wow, this place is cool and maybe I can afford it.
I don't know how much of that was actually going on. I don't know how much value was actually happening. But
zero. I agree with you.
But an aspect, going back to something that Jim Kunstler has written, Jim, can you talk a little bit about your observations of the aspect of suburbia being a place that nobody cares about?
Yeah, well, that's a big thing, you know.
We have plenty of time.
We have to remember with all this that societies do things because they seem to be a good thing to do at the time. You know, it wasn't a conspiracy to deprive people of authenticity. But it sort of ended up that way. And through a long series of things that happened, you know, we arrive at a place in the early 20th century where, now I don't want to recapitulate the whole history of the streetcar suburb and the railroad suburb and the automobile suburb, but what you finally get, you know, when the suburban experience kind of reaches full flower, is a cartoon version of a country house and a cartoon version of the country. You know, it's not really the country. It's a kind of abstract version of the country. It has all of the atomization of not being in the city, but it has none of the connection to natural systems and nothing really organic, organically functioning about it. And you know, it really didn't promise what it was supposed to deliver, which was country living for everybody. And, you know, there's a whole historical disposition in the American temperament about why we opted for a cartoon of country living. A lot of it had to do with the fact that our cities, for the most part, weren't all that nice and were created as a byproduct of industrialism per se. And so you get this desire to flee the city for something else, and that something else turned out to be a commodity version of country living that wasn't really the country, and that's really what it was.
Duo, do you do country houses or do you do suburban houses?
I do actually exurban, urban, and suburban houses, so I see all three markets. We do work in cities in densely populated, like low-rise cities, and also way out in like Ledyard, Connecticut, which is truly an exurb. So I think the one area which I tend to see things in the complete opposite from Jim. And Jim, I did buy your book, so, and I did read it, and I think it's a great book, and I think it's very provocative and well written. But one thing that I look at almost as a 180 flip is that I think in your very clear retrospective analysis of things, the one element which I think is reversed is I don't think people have in their mind prescribed, advertiser-driven, bank-driven, rich guy gets money out of the masses-driven desires for a life they don't have. When I built about 600 houses or renovated them, and I've never had anybody say to me in the 600 people that have asked me to do this, or probably more like a couple thousand, because not all the people that call me build anything, is never about, you know, I really want to live the life that I see on Dallas, or I never really want to have a place like the Kardashians, or I really wish that I lived like Tony Soprano. And in truth, I have had one client that showed me the Sopranos house. I have had somebody that has shown me interiors from TV shows. I understand all of that, but basically the truth is most people want a place, an individuated place, and it is narcissism and it is ego. They want a place that reflects their values, and the easiest, and I agree with you, the easiest way to do that, the short-circuiting way you do that is by having a blank palette, a piece of dirt, and an object in it that you inhabit. And that is the easiest way to control that microenvironment. So I think it's more about individual families and humans.
Well, first of all, I don't think I ever made that point that you're contesting. So, the vagaries of the market psychology was not something that I really had a lot to say about.
Well, you said that they were buying but you did just say that they were buying into some large overall false image of going to the country.
No, they were buying into the idea that the city was not a desirable place to be. So there had to be
because there were tenements there.
There had to be some antidote to city life, and the antidote to city life was country living.
Well, I think that's true, and I think there were cars and things that could take them there. I think the way you broke it down was very elegant, the trains and the trolleys and the cars. I think it was very, very elegant. It's absolutely directly true here in Connecticut, where all those systems came into play. And I can tell, but the one thing that I would reverse it is that I think that it was the creation of the transportation systems that allowed people not just to leave the city, but to have more control. I think the idea of having control is probably the reason why people build anything.
Well, there are lots of reasons why they build these things and why they inhabit them, but these systems certainly enabled a kind of behavior, and they seemed like a good idea at the time. We must also remember that this whole experience was really compressed into a very short period of time, you know, just a few generations.
Absolutely
and,
right.
And the intervals between the declension of these things from the railroad to the streetcar to the automobile, you know, it was microscopic, really. The incredibly elaborate streetcar system that America built from about 1890 to about 1930, okay, was a fantastic system, and it only lasted for about 40 years. You know,
in Connecticut, southwestern Connecticut, it lasted for 22 years.
Well, there you go.
It was this amazing little system.
It's just an eye blink in human history, let alone civilized. You know, the history of the last 5,000 years. It's a tiny little amount of time. So it ends up being really not a template of anything, but just sort of a weird anomaly, a weird historical anomaly that's certainly very interesting, but there's nothing really normal about it.
Right.
Well, can I posit one way of looking at it, which is self-serving because I've already posited it about the house? I do see an obvious, and this may be, you know, term limited or half-lifed because of all the factors you talk about in terms of energy and just the breakdown of systems. But I see the ability of people to control their destinations and their directions as more important than even the systems they employ. So that if a trolley could take you to your front door, you'd rather have a trolley probably than a car. But the truth is that the trolley can't take you to your front door, and a car can. If the car is cheap enough and there's a road there, people are going to want to be able to have the control to drive to their front door rather than take a trolley and walk. So I think there's an element of
I don't
human
necessarily disagree with any of those arguments. It seems to me that they're self-evident. The question really is, what will reality allow you to do? Yeah, and you know, for my money, reality will simply not allow Americans to continue living in this way that they may, you know, deem to be desirable for any number of reasons.
I want to put my two cents in here. I being a recent readopter of urban living, after I had just a series of happenstances, opened my eyes to the fact that I was spending inordinate amounts of time dispensing with the most basic chores of life.
Yeah.
I became absolutely sick unto death of having to drive for 20 minutes to do grocery shopping. When now that I live in the city, I can get basic necessities in 30 seconds by walking out my front door and 10 feet over to a bodega, or I can walk two blocks to a grocery store that has everything that I would want, or a few more blocks to a specialty store and get higher quality food than was available in even a very, very good grocery store in one of the most wealthy counties in the United States. And I just became really ill when I added up all the time that I was spending in my damn car, which cost me a good amount of money, and it also was depriving me of the opportunity to walk someplace and get some exercise. Now, in Duo, you say that it gives people control over their transportation, but driving from Rowayton, Connecticut, into my job in New York City was
a lot of fun, I'm sure.
Was not more convenient, nor did it take less time than walking to a train station and getting on a commuter rail. So it wasn't convenient.
Did you feel you had a lot of control sitting on I-95 in traffic?
No control whatsoever. Now, this coming from, you know, look, from when I was two through high school, I lived in suburbs. My mother thought nothing of driving 5 miles to buy a gallon of milk. And her family were early adopters of automobiles. And her family, her grandfather had an automobile from the very earliest time. I mean, he had a Model T. Now, he used it for his work because he was an oil well driller. And he drove, and he drove all over Pennsylvania and Kentucky and parts of southern Indiana where there were oil wells. So, for almost 100 years now, in my family, an automobile was a necessity. But I came to a point where I felt under pressure to have to rebel. And say, my quality of life is not better out in the country. And I was in the country. You know, I was in a hamlet that was settled in the 1640s. But I couldn't walk. I could not walk.
History.
Go ahead.
You know, I think that the real issue about suburbia is this, is that whether we built it and lived in it for a period of time with good intentions, the fact remains, it is a living arrangement with no future.
Absolutely.
And that's what we really have to contest with.
And we're... Yes. And we're...
Contend with, excuse me.
Yeah, well, contend with, or... I would like to think, because I'm one of those architects who is deeply steeped in city planning, I would like to be able to be in a position of offering alternatives that makes some sense of emerging economics. And I myself feel a lot under pressure. Joe, let's take another little short break, a couple minutes of David Bowie.
Ooh.
Burning Down the House, Curtis B. Wayne. We're talking about the changing landscape. The wrong people in the wrong streets. I had to have that in there. Well, I know in other books, Jim, you've written about a postulation of a possible future path. I myself would wish that the suburbs that are no longer sustainable because for one reason or the other. And look, from my own point of view, I've got three kids. Happy Father's Day, those of you who are fathers. I, being a father who cares about my kids under pressure of not wanting to be in the suburbs and being stranded as teenagers, all live in urban areas where they don't have to drive and they don't want to have a car. So I see that, and I work with a lot of younger people who are in the city because they don't want to have to drive. They don't want to have the expense of a car. They'd rather spend that money on, you know, having a fun time as young people, only worrying about rent and not about the expense of a car and relying on their bicycle or their feet or mass transit. So, Jim, you have some ideas about where things might go. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
My ideas are a little contrary to some of the conventional thinking out there. You know, you have guys like Ed Glaser at Harvard who expect the world to be all about skyscraper cities ad infinitum from here on. You know, I think that that's a crazy thing. You know, and then you have people like Joel Kotkin who think that, you know, suburbia is going to just keep on going no matter what. Here's what I think is going to happen. I think that our big cities are going to get into a lot of trouble, but in a different way than the suburbs. Our big cities, our metroplex cities, are not scaled to the energy and capital formation realities of the future. They're going to contract substantially, I believe. I don't know how disorderly that process is going to be. The fortunate ones will be the ones that can re-densify around their old cores, their old waterfronts, and perhaps railroad lines. And they're going to be a lot smaller than they are now. The suburbs, you can pretty much forget about. We're mostly not going to retrofit them. They have probably three destinies as slums, salvage yards, and ruins. There'll be a few of them that will be turned into something else.
I'm voting for the salvage yards.
I think there'll be a lot of that. For the following reason, the money is not going to be there, and the energy is not going to be there to fabricate all the kinds of building materials that we've gotten used to, even things as simple as concrete block. And you know, I think you'll have to forget about things like sheetrock, which are now normal for us, you know, but that's going to be very hard to fabricate.
Well, let me jump in here and ask
there's
you a question,
one more part of this. One more part of this. I think you're going to see people returning to the smaller towns and the smaller cities in the United States, the places that are the most deactivated now, the places that are in terrible condition. And it will be very important that these places have a meaningful relationship with agriculture, because that's going to come much closer to the center of our economic life than it has for generations.
What I hear you saying is essentially, and I'll speak to Architectese, that you say that the Corbeau version of Citradieu's of some huge towers in a park is crazy, and you're saying that the present situation of having huge cities that were designed around changing cores that have no sustainability will collapse, and you're saying that suburbs will collapse, but that exurbs that have access to farmland will become enriched and will take up the population.
I wouldn't call them exurbs. I'd stick with what I said. Small towns. We're going to have to
small independent
to living
towns.
In traditional towns, traditional villages, traditional neighborhoods, and traditional cities that are going to be smaller than our cities are now.
Because that, to me, almost sounds. But you're probably also saying that those towns will be true towns. They won't be suburbia with a town core and 1 acre lots.
Right.
Well, that sounds like Broadacre City to me. Sounds like Wright's vision of having relatively
high density.
No, it's not
Broadacre City. It was pure suburbia.
I'm talking about
the existing towns and cities that are out there now. That you know, the places like the Upper Hudson Valley, where I live, is full of former industrial towns and small cities and mill villages. You know, I live in one myself, and they're coherent, integral organisms that have been deactivated for the most part. They're going
to be reactivated. Broadacre City had a remarkable density to it. It was almost 12 units or 20 units to the acre if you analyzed it.
Broadacre City is Los Angeles.
Yeah, I agree with
about
Jim.
It.
Yeah. Here's one issue that you just, that Jim, you passingly speak to. About a month ago, here in New York City, I attended a workshop, a working session, day-long session, hosted by biocities.org, which is founded by a landscape architect, my friend Kathleen Bakewell. And the number one issue that was being discussed was food security. The fact that the grocery stores, any place that you go, anywhere in the Western world, has only 3 days of food on the shelves. We are incredibly beholden to the availability of cheap transportation to keep up, I don't want to use the word sustain, to just keep up the status quo in terms of food supply, which has been previously in history, was something that the government saw to. I mean, Pharaoh had his granaries, right? The French government built Les Halles in Paris as a market for the farmers to bring in their food. There was Covent Garden in London, and in New York there was an extensive system to bring in food from all over the area, from far west through the railroads, then across on barges to a rail system on the west side, which its remnant has now been turned into a park, the High Line. But the Washington Market, which was a huge, big food market, was torn down and replaced with housing. So in New York, I could easily see food riots happening if transportation was disrupted. And that would only take something happening to the GWB, because you cannot take tractor trailers.
That's exactly right, Curtis.
Through the tunnels. And so
it's a very fragile system.
Yeah, and so everybody at this BioCities session was talking about food security and the fact that even with urban farming, there's not enough arable land within 20 miles, which is about how far you could bring stuff through alternative transportation in from a farm into the city, if you could get it across the bridges or onto a boat and into Manhattan. Basically, Manhattan is fucked. Parts of Long Island are okay because there's ag out there. Way out in the Hamptons, you know, the Hamptons are really an island, and there's a causeway that goes across the Shinnecock Canal. If that went away, that little bit of New Island would probably do fine because there's a lot of ag out there, and I would see
how would Diddy go out to his house in the Hamptons to throw parties?
Well, he couldn't take the seaplane anymore, you know.
Can I posit one thing, Curtis? I think I'm the designated contrarian here. Can I posit that Pharaoh's granaries could end up essentially becoming then another George Washington Bridge, or another system of barges, or another system of rail transportation specifically to avoid food riots? The governments do respond to these sorts of things for self-preservation reasons and change the modes of transportation to allow people not to overturn the government.
I don't know.
Well, we'll see if we're capable of doing that. The whole railroad situation for me is a big beef, because I think we're going to desperately need good railroad transportation, and we're doing nothing to rebuild the conventional railroad system, and all we do is nurture fantasies about high-speed rail that are never going to happen, because
well,
the capital
true.
Is not going to be
that,
there.
100%.
So the we're ignoring this a rail system, a conventional system that was once the envy of the world not too long ago, that's lying out there rusting in the rain. And the fact that we're not even talking about it as a political issue shows that we're not a serious society.
I totally agree. Gentlemen, can we just take a very brief break of about a minute and a half and then rejoin?
Sure.
Next track, please. Down the House, Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, speaking with James Howard Kunstler, author of Too Much Magic and Duo Dickinson, architect and frequent guest here. Jim, I could not agree with you more apropos of the rails. I recently took a trip down to Charleston, South Carolina, a city that I think would fare very well in your scenario because it's surrounded by agriculture, it's on a two waterfronts, and it's a small town. If it contracted, there's plenty of land to build close to the historic downtown. It took 15 hours on Amtrak. It was supposed to be 13 hours, which is not so bad for a 900-mile trip, because they had to walk the tracks because the signals weren't working. This is 100.
Yeah, this is like the Bulgarian National Railway.
Yeah, 150-year-old technology, and the signals weren't working. And when we came close to Charleston, they had to walk the tracks in front of the train across a trestle because they were afraid that there might be a derailment or a misalignment of the rails. Pathetic. But we got there safely. And coming back, we were a half an hour early. I mean, go figure. You're absolutely right about, I mean, look, in my father's time, you could take the 20th Century Limited from Chicago to New York or vice versa as an overnight trip. You know, it was a land speed record for rail travel or something like that. You know, 1,000 miles in 13 hours or something ridiculous like that. Very, very fast.
Well, let me tell you why that's not possible now. Because, you know, a lot of it is because of a very stupid situation in New York State where the CSX Corporation was allowed to tear up the second track of the New York Central Railroad that ran from Albany to Buffalo. And they tore it up because there's an arcane real estate tax in New York State to penalize railroads that came out of the old populist Granger era in the 1890s. And, you know, it would take nothing at all for the legislature to just repeal that law or get rid of that law. But we are so not paying attention, we're so clueless, that we can't even remediate these situations when they have very simple solutions.
I hope the rights of way are still intact.
Well, they are, but they didn't. You know, they didn't want to. I mean, the second track just ran in the same right of way. It's just that there were two of them, and the reason that the passenger trains are uniformly not on time between New York and Chicago is because all the passenger trains have to step aside on sidings for the freight trains because they have priority, and so you get all these passenger trains being shunted onto sidings. Through the whole system, and they just never, you know, they can't leave and arrive on time. It's a pathetic system.
Yeah.
But that's one reason that it's pathetic.
Well, I would say, because I like to look on the bright side of life, I love the fact that that we have rail-to-trail systems all over the country, because we can now revert them to rail rights-of-way. when we have
That's
to.
That's true. It was a form of land banking for the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and
that is true.
Yeah, and that there's parkland all around Manhattan. Let's just suppose it somehow they work out food supply. You know, we could have rail lines along there. We could just, you know, say, okay, sorry about this, but do you want to eat, or are we going to have a couple of rail lines through the Riverside Park? Well, guess what? People who are really hungry are not taking a walk enjoying the scenery. But I do worry about there not being enough energy because, okay, so Jim, you take the point of view that there's going to be plenty of oil, but you just can't get to it. I think that just sooner or later, there's just not any oil anywhere. And I worry about the sufficiency of electricity.
Well, as a practical matter, I think that's true. You know, the fact that there may be a lot of oil under the Arctic Ocean will be immaterial if there's no way to get it, if there's no capital and no energy to get the energy.
Well, it's true that just...
the whole equation just...
Well, yeah, trillions and trillions of dollars seem to disappear every day. I mean, you know, Europe thought they were out of the tank, and now, oh, the ripple effect of... Oh, gosh, this so-called Great Recession, which is actually just a new kind of depression, the ripple effects are starting to pop up. You know, Greece is going to leave the Eurozone, probably. Spain is in the tank. They're just, you know, printing money to give around to where paper money, the euro, and then eventually the Yankee dollar will be about as worthless as continental Congress paper money was at the end of the American Revolution. And it's all because we just spent like drunken sailors on shore leave.
Well, can I agree with everything you guys said, but offer up maybe a Pollyanna-ish solution?
Go ahead.
Or a Pollyanna-ish perspective.
You just bought a solar automobile, right?
No. I think of it in a definitely a different way, which is essentially that if the market is free, if it isn't a command and control market, human beings, you know, want to eat, they want to live somewhere, they want to have a quality of life. If they are in a functioning, even a poorly functioning, democratic environment where they have freedom to do what they want to do, spend the money they want to spend, the money will create the solutions to the problem. The truth is that that might take a long time, and there might be a great deal of pain in between. But I think everything you're saying is correct. But I also think there's enough creativity and ingenuity that as these cities either depopulate or reconstitute themselves, as suburbs either survive or die, as any of these things happen, there's going to be enough money that people want, that have to spend on something, that solutions will be found to basically make people make change the paradigm. And I think what Jim says in his book is absolutely correct. It's foolish to say that there's magic technology and magic thinking and this all just solve itself because of quote-unquote technology. I think of it the other way around. I think that basically the human spirit is we're very good cockroaches. We survive terrible things and flourish in conditions that aren't always optimal. So I tend to take the half-full glass approach versus the half-empty glass approach.
Yeah, but Duo... the technology on which we rely so heavily
is terminal.
Well, I don't know that it's terminal, but it is very, very fragile.
I agree with that.
I mean, chip factories are exceptionally expensive, whether it's a large integrated circuit that you use in a computer, or the stuff that goes into our soundboard here at Heritage Radio Network, or the computers that our kids in the office are using to waste our time drafting stuff that they could have done faster in an analog method.
Right.
And if the technology is just not there as a replacement, which is something that, Jim, that's a point that you make in your book. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with James Howard Kunstler, author of Too Much Magic, observations on the precarious state of our current status quo. Jim, I think you're absolutely right. If there's not technology to replace the technology we have, gentlemen, I would suppose that we're going back to an analog era.
Well, you know, when I go around and do college lectures, there's always somebody who asks a question about won't all of our activities just migrate to the internet? You know, shopping, construction, everything. And you know, one thing that that these people don't get is that the internet depends entirely on a reliable electric grid.
Yeah.
And our electric grid is decrepit in the USA.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that the internet is going to somehow keep on chugging along without trillions upon trillions of dollars of investment in the electric grid is kind of a fatuous idea.
And and by the way, the internet wasn't the internet until there was the personal computer. It really was kind of useless when we used basically amped up teletype machines to communicate, say between between Harvard Design School and MIT, using ARPANET in 1976. It was it was pretty pathetic.
Well, I want to get back to something that was said a little while ago about you know, the human beings are resilient and they will prevail. I don't think that it's going to. I think that we're going to be a lot less affluent than we expect, and certainly a lot less than we are now. We are having tremendous problems with capital formation, and they are going to get a lot worse. But I would, you know, I don't disagree with the basic idea that societies and people respond to the circumstances that reality presents to them, and they tend to make adjustments. And I think that we will make adjustments. I just think that the changes are going to be a lot more severe than people expect. You know, most Americans think that we're going to run Walmart, Walt Disney World, and the interstate highway system by other means.
I would hope not.
Well, they do, for the most part, I can tell you, because I go all over the United States. This is what people believe.
I'm sure you do.
And, can I give you guys...
The basic idea is they're going to be disappointed in how that stuff works out.
Hold on.
One tiny anecdote that validates what you're saying, and it's totally anecdotal, and there's nothing scientific about it. But you could make a case that the most distended and obviously flawed and radically perverse house ever built is the classic McMansion. And the McMansion, as an item that is in a free market economy, is a dead ship on the water. Nobody wants it. They're not building them. It's over for the upper middle class 6,000 square foot house is a dead duck. And my sense is there are going to be a lot of other McMansions out there in the economy, and they will die of their own weight because of their absurdity and their non-utility.
Yes.
Well, listen, this is an architecture show, right?
Hold on.
Yes.
Hold on. We probably have at least another 10 or 12 minutes to wrap this up. Let's just take another little break so that I can form some cogent thoughts of my own. Let's have a little analog music from the 20th century.
And you know the sun's setting fast, and just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. Well, go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye to our town.
There's your McMansion music. Kiss it goodbye. All right, you were saying.
Well, I just want to make a point about the architectural scene. I think that one of the big problems we're going to face is that the skyscraper is obsolete. And not for reasons that most people might even imagine. It's not necessarily because of the heat and the air conditioning or the elevators. It's because from now on, these buildings will never be renovated, because the capital is not going to be there to do it, and probably the fabricated modular materials are not going to be there.
I'm so glad go ahead.
And everything from the sheetrock to the silicon gaskets that have to hold in the curtain walls. And so when you see something like Frank Gehry's new 80-story condo building in downtown New York, and, you know, these are tragic buildings. They are liabilities, not assets. And the places that are overburdened with them are going to be hammered.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I happen to work in a firm that is especially expert in making these glass towers. Our claim to fame are two very glassy buildings, four Times Square and one Bryant Park, the Bank of America building. And you know, we talk about this, that the glass will have to be replaced within 30 years. We know that some glass will have to be replaced. But I have to say, you're down on skyscrapers. You think that they're useless.
No, I don't think they're useless. I think they have a use, but I don't think that they're going to be useful going forward. I think we're going to have a huge problem.
Not as office buildings, but but wherever you have south-facing glass, the number one problem with a really tall building or any large building, as Duo knows, as any architect knows, is cooling. They're excellent excellent greenhouses. You get excellent daylight at least 20 feet into the building plate, and the north side, because of constant light, is excellent for workshops. So I see vertical integration of people making things in old office towers. Where they have glass, where they don't, people will still be making plywood. Now, they're not going to be the beautiful modernist things. They're going to be kind of hodgepodge adaptations. You remember when the Hancock Building in Boston lost all of its glass and it was the world's tallest plywood.
I was living in Boston when that happened.
Right, the world's tallest plywood building.
Interesting building, yeah.
It was. I see that in the midterm, that a lot of these buildings end up with ad hoc skins and have different uses than were intended. Because you can get real good ventilation on the 30th floor by opening one small opening on one side and another small opening on the other.
You know, Venturi effect just blows it out.
The Venturi effect's going to suck all that air right straight through, free cooling. If we have some electricity to keep the elevators running, I see vertical factories with agriculture where there's daylight and workshops where there's not. But that's just my blue sky.
Forget
thing.
About it. That's a fantasy that ain't going to pan out.
Well, the structure is good for at least 500 years. The glass.
I saw the preview of coming attractions in downtown Johannesburg, where all the towers had become vertical slums and were being one by one decommissioned because they were falling apart inside. And they'll never be rebuilt. But and that's an extreme example, but it is nonetheless the best one for the moment to go look at.
Well, that was South Africa. South Africa also had huge race problems. I hope that we won't see that happening in North America, but you never know.
Well, there was an architect who a talk I heard at least 10 years ago, and I forget her name. She was brilliant, but she had a very similar post-apocalyptic vision that there will be in every city the first 8 floors of all the skyscrapers will be occupied because that's where you could that is where you can effectively walk up if you're in shape, and the top 20, 80, 100 floors will end up being completely desolated. Because the idea that energy will be so costly that elevators won't work and that heating systems won't work. And so she was thinking about it very similar to Jim, that they become these totems of a past hubris that went awry.
So. Well, there are all kinds of other things that are going to happen that we are giving no thought to. One of them is that the homeowners associations are going to fail. We have seen only what happens on the way up when you construct a massive infrastructure of homeowners associations and build massive buildings with deconstructed rights of real estate, where each unit is owned separately. The fact is, it takes very few failures of the financing of the units to skew make inoperable the homeowners associations. And so then the question will arise in a lot of these buildings, who's going to take care of them?
Jim, can I ask you one question? Because it's very interesting, because I hear a common thematic underlay of everything you're saying. What I hear you saying more than anything else is that the system that is the most unsustainable, the system that is the most terminal, is the financial system. That the way,
correct,
essentially capital is raised, allocated, and returns come back, you see as basically being a dead system walking. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yeah.
It's a very interesting take, because I don't know enough about it to know if it's true or not. But the truth is that if you are correct, everything in your book is correct.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait around and see how things play out.
Well, the good news is we'll know if it's true or not in one way or another.
Yeah.
So it's not the oil per se. It's the ability to extract that oil, or I suppose by extension, coal.
And the, well, it's also that and the relationship between energy inputs into an economy and capital formation ability within that economy.
Right.
Those are very, very closely related.
It's all pure energy. Without the capital to get the energy, you can't keep the systems going.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see whether we return to a Ruritarian analog society. If the continents break up into city-states that are trading raw commodities with each other for, I don't know, wampum? Or just swapping?
Silver.
Silver's on a good high, isn't it? Yeah.
Or it could just be marijuana.
Well, I wrote a couple of novels that in the post collapse future. They were published in 2008 and 2010.
You want to flog those?
Pardon me?
Tell us what they were.
The novels were World Made by Hand was the first one, and the sequel was The Witch of Hebron.
Mm-hmm.
And they were set in a small town in upstate New York, much like the one that I'm living in now. And it was
you took us where your mindset is. Clearly.
Well, I wanted to vividly portray what I was trying to get across in a way that would get to a different part of people's brains than just a discursive, polemical nonfiction book.
Yep.
And I was able to do it because I had experience writing novels, so I thought I would do it. So I did it.
Well, your point about Big Ag is well taken. Without a lot of petrochemical additives for the soil, without nitrogen and potassium, fertilizers, Big Ag doesn't work. And in that world, only the people who have either they're doing the Steiner system of biodynamic farming and relying on the healing power of ground quartz crystals, or they have some kind of, or they have some in which they truly believe. No joke. Or we have organic produce, which has got a crapshoot failure rate depending on the weather and locusts and other pests. I'm voting for the nation states, but alas, the weather in Charleston is just too humid for me, and it would kill me.
And they do have some extremely large bugs there, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
That are fairly terrifying.
Which is too bad, because there is a college down there that I visited, the American College of
it's
Building
beautiful.
Arts.
Beautiful.
And, yeah, have
Great
you been there?
Yes.
I've lectured there maybe four times in the last
and
year.
They're,
it's a beautiful city.
And they're learning traditional analog building crafts, so there is a future for them. And there's still a future for me. Duo, I don't know about you, but I still have my analog design skills. I have my slide rule. I know how to calculate a structure up to 3 stories tall without the use of a computer. And I'm trying to teach my younger colleagues how to draw. Because unfortunately, they weren't required to learn how to draw, a lot of them, in architecture school. What a world.
Unfortunately, the majority of my brain was formed in about 1976, so I'm pretty much set for the future, even if it's a high-tech, feudal world like Jim is suggesting.
It can't come sooner, as far as I'm concerned. This has been Burning Down the House with Jim Kunstler and Duo Dickinson. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.